When Kimberly...
Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Joe Biden is president-elect. In fact, he just finished his first address on coronavirus just a few minutes ago. This hour, we're going to take your calls to find out what your reaction is to the new president and vice president and what you think the next 4 years will have in store. Plus, we'll hear some audio from a celebration in St. Petersburg on Saturday. Did you attend one where you are? Let us know about that. Later on in the show, my guest is a law professor, and we'll talk about the legal issues still at stake in this post-election period. I'm going to give you the number right now to join the conversation. It's 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. Please sign your name and tell us where you're calling from if you do text. And I want to thank the three listeners who left voicemails after last Monday's show. Since the news has changed so much in the last week, I decided against playing them, but thanks. I appreciate you sending me those voicemails. But first, before we get to the presidential election, I want to play you a story from Daniel, our news reporter. We're going to take a short diversion from election news. In late September, a white man pulled a gun on Black Lives Matter protesters in St. Petersburg. The man who aimed the gun has been identified as Lawrence Arnold Davis. WMNF's Daniel Figueroa IV reports an investigation is ongoing, but lawyers representing a woman who Davis allegedly pushed to the ground before pulling the gun are calling for the lead prosecutor to recuse himself.
When Kimberly Cox saw the news of George Floyd's killing by Minneapolis police, it woke something inside her. For the first time, she said, she felt called to act. Part of that call came from the need to use her voice as an ally for the Black community.
It's so incredibly sad how these marginalized people and their voices are stifled. And if I can use my voice in any way to help them in any way, then I'm going to do it.
And part of that call came from hearing Floyd's cry for his mother.
I'm a mom, and I know that if my child was calling for me, I would want somebody to answer that call if I couldn't.
Cox began participating in protests almost immediately. She's marched more than 100 times since May, both in her home county of Pasco and in St. Petersburg. In that time, cars have run into protesters and she's been threatened, but despite violent protests in other cities, police in St. Petersburg and Newport Richey said there hadn't been any reports of harassment or property damage on the part of protesters over more than 4 months. But that changed in September after a Tampa Bay Times reporter released video of a verbal confrontation between protesters and diners on Beach Drive. Then, the counter-protesters showed up. The Saturday after the video released, tensions came to a head.
The beginning of that night, Black leadership was discussing how important it was and trying to get us mentally prepared that right around the corner, the opposition was already lining up and trying to get us mentally prepared that they were going to be saying some nasty and vile things to us immediately upon starting the march. The first corner that we went around, there were agitators in the groups.
The St. Pete Peace Protest, as it was called, had been marching most nights. Understanding the narrative, members practiced de-escalation techniques and had been encouraged not to engage. That Saturday in September, Cox said counter-protest groups followed, shouting racial slurs and trying to antagonize protesters. But the less protesters reacted, the more agitated the counter-protesters became. Cox said one group in particular was being so abrasive, she said her fear was palpable. Then, a man later identified as Lawrence Davis got physical.
He takes both of his hands open-handed right on my, right above my breast and shoves me so hard that I land on my tailbone and my elbow, and then my head bounced up and hit the concrete twice and I lost consciousness.
Cox, a slim-built white woman, was unconscious, but video shows two Black men, members of the de-escalation team, came to her aid, coming between her and Davis. That's when video shows Davis pull a gun and chamber around, pointing it at numerous protesters. Police showed up at the protest, but no one was arrested and no report was filed. Following the incident, police said two Black men appeared to have knives. Slowed video from the night, however, appears to show what was thought to be a knife was a bandana in one case and a cell phone in another. Attorneys Johnny Bardeen and Megan Fernandez represent Cox and said the men are being treated unfairly.
These men are victims of a violent crime. They are not being treated as such.
Cox eventually filed a report which was sent to the state attorney's office. Assistant State Attorney Anthony Carlo was assigned to the case. During a victim interview, Bardeen said Carlo was aggressive and attempted to bully the lawyers and their client.
I was appalled by the tenor and the tone of that interview.
Fernandez, who herself was an assistant state attorney before going into private practice, said she'd never seen a victim treated that way.
So I'm sitting there, his hands are shaking, he's becoming red-faced, he is enraged, he can't even hardly hold his pen.
After assistant state attorney Carlo abruptly ended the interview, Bardeen and Fernandez said they were able to have a more successful interview with another assistant state attorney, but the case is still Carlo's. Now that more than a month has passed since the incident, the lawyers are calling for Davis to be charged. They say hate crime charges are appropriate because of the racial motivation behind Davis's attack. Bardeen and Fernandez also want Carlo to be recused from the case, not just because of his confrontational tone toward their client, but his background in law enforcement. Cox and the two black men Davis appeared to pull a gun on were marching against police brutality. Davis was part of a pro-police counter-protest. And in multiple social media posts, Davis shows support for committing violent acts against protesters, including shooting them. Due to offensive language in the posts, they can't be shared on air, but you can watch them at WMNF.org. As police violence against the black community continues in 2020, including the killing of Walter Wallace Jr. in Philadelphia, Bardeen and Fernandez said this is a chance for law enforcement and prosecutors to show that there aren't separate systems of justice depending on who you are or what you believe in.
This is an opportunity for folks in those positions to demonstrate their commitment to justice for everyone.
The fact that these issues aren't crystal clear to law enforcement and to the state attorney's office, it shows that they're not paying attention or that they really just genuinely do not grasp the issue. And both of those things are pretty scary to me.
The Pinellas Pasco State Attorney's Office did not respond to multiple requests for comment. For WMNF News, I'm Daniel Figueroa IV.
All right, well, you're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. This is Sean Canaan. You're listening to Midpoint Monday, and that was our story from Daniel Figueroa IV about an incident that happened about five or six weeks ago where a white man who was counter-protesting against the Black Lives Matter protesters actually shoved a woman to the ground and then pulled a gun on several of the Black Lives Matter protesters. So I'm happy to chat about that story if you'd like to. Have you been at a protest where you've seen violence, or if you've heard threats at a protest, or if you'd like to talk about the election, give us a call. Here's the number, 813-239-9663. You can also text us at 813-433-0885, or you can email dj@wmnf.org. I'm going to give priority today to people who don't call in all the time to these talk shows. So if you're a first-time caller or even like a second or third-time caller, give us a call. I'll give priority to women, of course. So just give us a call at 813-239-9663. Let me read an email that came in early in the show. Cheryl writes, and this is about a discussion that we're having in this hour, of course, but also it was happening during last hour during Radioactivity. Cheryl writes, yes, I believe there would have been protests if Trump won. Four more years of Trump would be unacceptable. Any violence would come from Trump supporters who would not understand or accept our right to protest. That's what Cheryl has to say out there in cyberspace. On Saturday afternoon, there were a lot of demonstrations all over the world, really. I heard bells ringing in Paris and things like that. But around the Tampa Bay area, there were demonstrations. And in St. Petersburg, a person who had just won a seat on Tuesday was there. And so Caprice Edmond, she just won a seat for the Pinellas County Board of County Commissioners. And she will be representing the southern part of the county at the Biden celebration there in St. Petersburg. I asked her first about her reaction to being elected, and then later on you'll hear how she reacted to the victory by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
Speechless. The overwhelming support from the community is, I'm just appreciative of the support, and I'm looking forward to doing the work as we move forward with advocating for our children as an elected official.
Moving to today, when you first heard the news, what did you think?
I am excited that we have elected officials or people in office that are going to really care about public education. I'm looking forward to seeing the slate. I'm looking forward to seeing who's going to be the Secretary of Education so we can really make moves for our children.
Would you like Betsy DeVos to continue to be the Secretary of Education?
Absolutely not. The goal for privatization has really hindered many components of public education. The practices and policies have not been equitable and have been harmful for public education.
Well, that was Caprice Edmond. I spoke to her on Saturday. She's Pinellas School Board member-elect, and she was at a Joe Biden victory celebration in downtown St. Petersburg. It was right across the street. Well, it started right across the street from City Hall, but as our WMNF web team and Facebook team have documented, that is, it continued throughout lots of parts of the city. So if you have something to say about that, you can give us a call at 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. And I want to go now to Wendy in Seminole. Hi, Wendy. Thanks so much for calling. What would you like to say?
Hey, I've got a question I tried to email, but long story, I can't get it to go through. You know, the news is out today. Mitch McConnell has said that, he'll do everything in his power to block Joe Biden, including his cabinet positions, you know, from the time whenever it's declared, And my question is, if he could do that, why couldn't he just point acting cabinet people like Trump's done for the last 2 years?
I'm going to drop you, Wendy, because I think you're hitting a button. But so Mitch McConnell blocking the Biden picks. That's something that, you know, he maybe put that in verbally today or recently, but that's something that people have been expected. I mean, think about Merrick Garland was blocked in the last year of the Obama presidency. So I'd like to know what our listeners think about that. What do you think about Mitch McConnell while he's still in the majority, which is now, and potentially even after January, he'll still be in the majority, they get a say. The Republican Senate, the Republican-led Senate, will have a say in confirming picks. You could make the case that recess appointments could be made. What do you think about all that dynamic? I appreciate Wendy bringing that up. Sorry I had to drop you. Your phone was acting a little funky. But I would like to know what our listeners think. 813-239-9663. I have a listener who called in and said that he wanted to correct me that Biden is not officially the winner. That is true. Joe Biden has been declared by the media and by the people who are counting the ballots as the president-elect, which means he will be the next president. Of course, the results still have to be official. The Electoral College still needs to meet and so forth. So that is true. From a technical standpoint, it is true. But he is the president-elect. That's just what's happened. I know the person who called in doesn't want to hear that, but that's the truth. 813-239-9663. I want to go a little bit more, just a couple of sound bites, one or two more sound bites that I captured over the weekend that you may have heard over this morning, but I just want to play one. But I want to hear if you have went to any protests against Joe Biden being elected, or if you went to any celebrations of Joe Biden being elected, and if you have any thoughts about that. And I do want to remind you that at the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to a law professor about what the legal strategy is for, well, I don't know if she's going to talk necessarily about the strategy, but what legal avenues there are and some other things about the election. And we'll talk about that. And you can call in about any topic about the Biden campaign. I especially am looking for people who haven't called in recently. Let's go right now to Lee in Spring Hill. Hi, Lee. Let me put you on the air. I think I'm going to have to come back to you, Lee. But Ed in Clearwater, you're on the air now. Ed.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can. You're on.
Okay, let me turn off my radio here in the background. So with the shooter and whatnot, I saw a meme from the right wing say, oh, hey, there were so many angry Republicans and not a city was burned down. And they always like to call these dog whistles and say, people are disrespecting our officers, this, that, the other. They were not out on the streets. I would like to point out a lot of their tactics are deflection. So they take whatever is pointed at them or whatever the president does, and then they blame someone else for doing it. The people were out there. I believe I saw Caprice Edmonds at the C.G. Woodson Black History Museum before everybody else went celebrating down Central. And it was kid-friendly, peaceful. People were more relieved than anything. So I believe it's just nice to see, for myself particularly, a president quote the Bible and not have to shoot people with rubber bullets just for a photo op for one. And with Mitch McConnell, I believe the middle America, I consider myself more independent than anything, came out in droves and voted. So hopefully that'll be a red flag to him that people should cooperate. And like Joe had mentioned, you know, your opponent doesn't have to be your enemy, but it's more of a demonic villainization that, you know, they continue drinking the Kool-Aid on, and just deflect that. So those are my thoughts.
Great. I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Ed. I'm going to move on, but I thank you for calling in, and thanks for telling us what's on your mind. And we'll move now to Lee in Spring Hill. Lee, you want to comment on the election and on McConnell?
Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham, they maintained that their reelection was legitimate, and only Biden. So, I mean, Mitch McConnell is a great show of cowardice in the face of, you know, truth. And then the other thing is Trump's got a thing out there. He wants money sent in so that you can sponsor his lawsuits. But he's supposed to be a billionaire. And he also said he was going to write a $100 million check to his campaign. So where'd all that money go?
Again, I didn't check on how much Trump spent of his own money on his campaign. I should have done that before the election, but I didn't. But, you know, and I think it's pretty typical when there is a post-election fight for there to be campaign fundraising, campaign-like fundraising for the money for the recounts. And I think it's pretty legitimate to, especially, let's say, Georgia. There's going to be a state-mandated, I think, recount in Georgia. And that's going to take lawyers, and that's going to take funds for probably both candidates and both parties. And, you know, I think these are all pretty normal things, and to challenge certain irregularities, if you think there are. But I think the point is that that there has not been widespread voter fraud, and that it appears as if, with the unofficial results in, that Joe Biden has won enough states, enough electoral college votes by a wide enough margin that even if there are some, even if the Trump administration successfully challenges a few mail-in ballots here in Pennsylvania, a few in Arizona, whatever it is, it wouldn't make a difference in those races. And there's really no way to overturn the result that the American people voted for, which was that the electoral college win will go to Biden. Now, we could get into the point of, and hopefully maybe I'll talk with this about with my law professor guest in about 10 minutes, but, you know, it's possible that a conservative state legislator in a state that went blue could have a disloyal elector, appoint electors that do not vote for Joe Biden. I mean, that's entirely possible. I think that would not, the appetite for the country, the country might not have that. What do you think? I'm talking a lot. What do you think, Lee?
Well, there's a disclaimer at the bottom of their fundraising drive for this money for the recounts that they can use it to pay off retired debt from the campaign. And my thing is, dear old Donald keeps, you know, saying how he's a billionaire. He shouldn't. A grifter takes up and never wants to spend his own money on anything. And instead of Donald just paying off his, if he's that rich, which I doubt, paying off his own campaign debt, he's going to try to get it, you know, these poor guys that are believing that they're going to spend the money on the recount.
Yeah, that's I think that you should be honest when you have a fundraiser. Hey, so I want to ask you one thing before I move on, Lee. Yeah. You're in Spring Hill. I've driven through Spring Hill during this election season just once, but I have, and I saw a heck of a lot of Trump signs. What are your neighbors saying, and what's the mood there?
Well, you got a lot of Trump flags along with the Confederate flag. There's actually like 20,000 more registered Republicans in Hernando County than there are Democrats. There's like 40,000 Democrats and 40,000 independents, and I know that because I was a election poll worker on November 3rd. Okay, and those figures are given out. But I really don't talk that much to the neighbors. I'm a Democrat. There isn't a whole lot of exchange of views.
All right. Thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate that. 813-239-9663 if you'd like to join this conversation. And there is an open phone line right now. You can email in at dj@wmnf.org. I want to remind people that in just a few minutes, we're going to have a law professor on, and we're going to talk about the election and the post-election situation. So let's go now to Alan in Tampa. You're on 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. You're on WMNF's Midpoint Monday. Alan, what would you like to say?
Hey, I want to say thanks so much for taking my call and all you do, Sean. I'll keep it brief. I'm ecstatic that Biden won. I think that I'm 65 years old, never seen the country so divided where I can't talk to certain neighbors now because it just seems impossible to keep politics out of it as much as I try to avoid it. I think it's sad. And I hope that we turn the corner now. And as Biden has promised to be a president for all people, like all of them should be, that we can recover from this. What really got my goat was McConnell trying to block this transition. I mean, all of these people that were elected for the United States, for all Americans, and they've forgotten it. And even though my neighbors have forgotten it, I'm sure some of yours have, it's appalling that our educated, supposedly polished, professional, dedicated elected officials have just abandoned that whole concept, and it's strictly about the party. It's about drinking the Kool-Aid. It's disgusting. And I hope we can get past it.
All right, Alan, thank you so much. Thanks for calling in. I'm going to go now to George in Sarasota. George, what's it like, before we get to your point, I'm sorry to hog the conversation here again, but I want to know what it's like in other parts. I mean, I've been in Tampa, I've been in St. Pete in the last few days, but what's it like in Sarasota? What's the mood like?
Hey, good afternoon. I really haven't been outside very much, so I really don't know. Just driving around town through the last few days, I haven't seen anybody on the streets, nothing really. There's kind of fewer Trump flags on people's yards. I've noticed that people seem to have taken stuff down somewhat, but I haven't noticed really anything.
Okay, I appreciate that. Now go ahead. What did you call in for?
Well, I guess my Joe Biden, I think, is a good, solid person, and I'm really, really relieved. There's a huge, sense of relief in him being elected. However, I think liberals are basically people, progressives who, love this country and love what the principles of this country are founded upon, need to understand that I think that Trump is a symptom. The disease has, Trump is just the worst manifestation of a disease that's infected the Republican Party and conservative politics for the last 20, 30 years. And that disease still has a strong grip. And that I think we need to completely expect there's going to be a full court obstruction, attempts to delegitimize Biden's presidency. You're going to see it doesn't matter what Democrats elected. I think you need to understand the nature of what this opposition is. And I'm sorry to say, I don't think it's something you can negotiate with. I think there's a fundamental battle over the soul of the country. And I think the nature of the opposition what they're doing is basically mobilizing fear, anger, fear, rage, and destruction. And that's the nature of their tactics, and that will continue.
All right. Thank you, George. I appreciate your thoughts. I hope that you're wrong on some of the more dire predictions, but I do think that I appreciate your thoughts on that. Thanks. Thanks so much for calling in.
Well, to me, unfortunately, I don't think it should be hope. I think we need to look clearly at what the nature of the opposition is. And the problem with being liberal and progressive as I am is you always kind of hope for the best in people. You hope that people are going to wake up. But I think you also do yourself a disservice by living in a dream. I think we need to look clearly at what the nature of what's going on here.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, George. Let's go now to Daryl in Tampa. Hi, Daryl. Thanks for calling in. What would you like to say?
Hey, how you doing?
Very good.
Well, kind of wanted to address some other things, but what really caught my attention was that news brief that you played about the person pulling the gun. That was here in Florida?
This was in St. Petersburg at the end of September. Just to summarize, this person allegedly, and most of this was caught on video, allegedly shoved a woman, the woman you heard from at the beginning of the story, shoved her to the ground. She got knocked unconscious. And then some people from the Black Lives Matter march went to, you know, intervene, not physically intervene, but just get between the two of them. And at that point, the white man who was a counter-protester pulled a gun. And that's, you know, it ended, the escalation ended there, except there was this detail where the two black men who came in between were condemned essentially by the police and as if they had weapons. And so in the reporting that we've done since then and others, it's been determined that those weren't weapons. It seems like one was a bandana and one was a mobile phone, but the person who pulled the gun has not yet been charged. So I just summarized the story we played at the beginning of the show.
Let me say this quickly. And I got something for your professor when it come on, to my understanding, Florida is not an open carry state. I believe I'm correct.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I'm pretty sure the story is that the person was concealed carrying, and presumably they had a right to conceal carry, and then only drew the weapon once they felt threatened or whatever. But
once you pull that out of that conceal, now you open carrying that. Okay, and that's grounds to charge you right there. And what a lot of people, I'm not with the defund the police. I'm for, if I could find the words, to retool or reform. I'm for reforming the police. And see, that is the problem that a lot of people have with our various police agencies around this nation. What happened with George Floyd, what happened in Kenosha, Wisconsin, what happened with Breonna Taylor, okay? They are totally out of line for what they did. And you want our support. Look, when my house was I was in it and was attempted to be burglarized, I didn't call any activists. I called 911, and I wanted the police to come there. Okay, I'm not for defunding the police, but I'm for reforming it. And something else you played, you said something about Ron DeSantis. He wants to do something in Michigan, basically the same thing that Lindsey Graham wants to do in Pennsylvania, even though he's not from Pennsylvania, he's from South Carolina. They want to ignore the voters and just for the people. I forgot what do you call them, to go ahead and give their vote towards the Republican Party. That's what they do in two-bit, ten-horn dictatorships. So you want to defund, I don't care what color they are, black or white, you want to defund people, you want to disenfranchise people's votes, and that's wrong. But what I would like for you to ask the question of the professor when she comes on, if you're still there.
I am here. Wrap it up, please, Daryl.
Yeah, I'm going to get off. But I would like the question I would like to ask, if Joe Biden, I don't think he's going to do it as long as those two Senate seats are out, haven't been decided on. Isn't there a presidential way that he can go around the Senate to get the cabinet members that he wants to, maybe presidential edict? And that's what I wanted to say.
All right, Daryl, thank you so much for your call. And we are going to bring on my guest. And Chara Torres-Spellacy is a professor at Stetson University College of Law. Welcome to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. Give me one second. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right, I appreciate you bearing with me. Trying this new technology. We're doing a Zoom call right now, and she's joining us from Stetson. And why don't we start with that first question? I think you heard our listener, Daryl, and you may not, this might not be your expertise, but he was concerned about what happens if a red state, a state with a governor and or a legislature has decides to go against the will of the voters and to give put unfaithful electors into the Electoral College. Is that something you're prepared to address? I don't know if we talked about that.
Yeah. So the most recent ruling from the Supreme Court on unfaithless electors was a case called Chiraffalo. I'm probably killing that person's name. My apologies. Out of Washington State. And the question there was whether states could punish faithless electors. And the Supreme Court said that you could punish a faithless elector precisely for the reason that the faithless elector is not going with the will of the vote of the people in that state. So that doesn't address the question of the caller precisely, but I think it shows where the Supreme Court head is at. And I would think that if a state tries to push faithless electors in this particular election, that that might be one of the few cases that the Supreme Court would entertain and would say no to.
And the Supreme Court, the precedent that you were talking about was, of course, before Amy Coney Barrett was on this court, and you still, it sounds like you think that even with her on the court, that they would still might reject something as radical as having faithless electors?
Correct. The faithless electors, if I recall correctly, I think that was unanimous with some concurrences from Gorsuch and Thomas. But even though there was a little bit of disagreement textually about which part of the Constitution would control, I think Gorsuch and Thomas were looking at it as a 10th Amendment issue, and the rest of the court was looking at it as a 12th Amendment. I know no one knows what the 12th Amendment does, but it was basically a solution to the tie that happened in the 1800 election for president, which it created the system we have now, which makes presidents and vice presidents run as a ticket.
Can I confuse history for a second just to make a really bad joke? That wasn't the one where it was decided by a duel, was it?
No, but Alexander Hamilton had a key role in the election of 1800, because when that tie happened, it went to the House of Representatives to choose the president. And then they tied, like, I think 36 times in a row. And Alexander Hamilton actually influenced his own party, even though he didn't agree with Jefferson on much of anything. He really hated Aaron Burr. I guess the feeling was mutual. And so Hamilton used his influence to have his party vote for Jefferson, which is how Aaron Burr loses that election, becomes vice president, and then, you know, years later, duels with Alexander Hamilton and kills him.
Wow. All right. Our guest is Chara Torres-Pellacy, a professor at Stetson University College of Law. And we're talking about the post-election legal milieu, I guess. President Trump has promised that there will be legal action in the coming days. He has refused to concede the presidency after his loss to Democrat Joe Biden. And let's talk about some of the things that might be coming through the courts. One is in Pennsylvania. The Trump campaign last week won an appellate ruling to get party and campaign observers closer to election workers who are processing mail-in ballots in Philadelphia. The order did not affect the counting of ballots that's proceeding in Pennsylvania. I find it hard to believe that that is anything that's going to escalate all the way up to the Supreme Court. But what about the idea that in Pennsylvania, it's this year, it's legal to count ballots that arrive after Election Day, and they're segregating those ballots in Pennsylvania, if I have that right. Is that something that the Supreme Court might end up ruling on?
So the Supreme Court already ruled on this pre-election. This was during the brief period where Ruth Bader Ginsburg had died and Justice Barrett had not been confirmed yet. So it was an 8-8 split. Whenever the Supreme Court ties, that means that whatever happened in the lower court stands. And what had happened in the lower court was the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, looking at their own state law, said that Pennsylvania was able to take ballots that arrived 3 days late, so long as they were postmarked by Election Day. And so that's where that stands right now. They are segregating those ballots. It's possible that they might revisit this in the Supreme Court. But if they segregate out those ballots and the number of ballots segregated wouldn't change the result in Pennsylvania, then I think it's unlikely that the Supreme Court is going to hear that particular case.
And just to clarify something, I think you said you accidentally said 8-8 tie, but it was a 4-4 tie when there were eight justices.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Yeah. No problem.
There are not 16 members on the court yet.
Not yet. Yeah, right. That was in jest, of course. 813-238-8239, that is, 9663. If you'd like to join this conversation, my guest is Chara Torres-Pellacy, a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law. A judge in Georgia dismissed last week a lawsuit by the state Republican Party and President Trump's campaign that asked him to ensure that Chatham County, which is where Savannah is, was following state laws on processing absentee ballots. So Georgia is a very close state. They appear to be or already are heading toward a recount. And so that one is a state where it might make a difference who wins that state. But still, it seems that when all is said and done, Georgia itself might not make that big of a difference. Is there anything that you have to add about that Georgia case or even just the idea of how far these things are going to proceed once it appears crystal clear who the next president's going to be?
So in the lower courts, not just in Georgia, there have been various attempts by either the Trump campaign or Trump nominally to stop counting or to change the observers who are watching the counting. And courts, with the exception of the Pennsylvania case that you referenced earlier, have mostly said no to the Trump campaign and have dismissed these suits already. Now, in our legal system, that is usually not the end of it. When you have litigious people, they can appeal that to higher courts and they can try to get it in front of the Supreme Court. But it's important to remember that the Supreme Court has control over its docket, which means that you petitioned for cert at the Supreme Court, but they always have the ability to say no. And traditionally, the Supreme Court says no like 90 to 95% of the time. And I think there's a real institutional reason for the Supreme Court to stay out of this. I think they got a black eye when they decided Bush versus Gore. And I don't think they want another one in this election.
Although one of the justices, I believe it was Kavanaugh last week, used Bush v. Gore as a precedent and for one of his is it called decisions? One of his, when he wrote what he thought last week, he used Bush v. Gore as a precedent.
Yeah, that's a little peculiar because if you read Bush v. Gore carefully, it says that it's not meant to be precedential. I think what the court was thinking about in Bush v. Gore is that was an extraordinarily rushed opinion for the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, under normal circumstances, can take infinite time to decide an opinion. There are cases, like there's a case called McGrain, where the court held onto it for several years before issuing an opinion, and that is their prerogative. But because of the timing of the presidential election under the Constitution, the court felt very rushed. And so they did issue a opinion very rapidly. But I think they also noted that it was done in great haste. And I think because of that haste, they put in a provision in the decision itself that it would only apply to Bush v. Gore itself. And it of course, it's the Supreme Court's ultimate prerogative to dust off Bush v. Gore and ignore that part. But the other really bizarre thing is lower courts in the intervening 20 years have also cited Bush v. Gore, even though it says it's non-precedential.
And I wonder if instead of rushing in the first place, why didn't they just take their time and get it right or say, you know, we don't have enough time to decide this? I don't know. I mean, there's no way to go back in history, but it seems if you're going to say we might be getting it wrong, don't look at this in the future. All right.
Well,
our guest is Chara Torres-Spellacy. She's a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law in Gulfport. And you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday. It's 12:46 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan. And you can call in at 813-239-9663. We'll probably take calls in just a few minutes after I let our guest go. What can you say, Professor Torres-Spellacy, about the U.S. Postal Service and the delays that were happening right before the election? And there were a flurry of rulings by judges and there was a lot of action going on when it comes to the Postal Service and the legal avenues that they were doing. So what can you say about all that?
I think it's sorely disappointing to see a institution like the U.S. Postal Service, which is created by the U.S. Constitution, so bullied and battered and just made dysfunctional at a key point in American history. And so I hope that the new Congress, even if it's a divided Congress, which is what it looks like it's going to be with a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, that they could come to a agreement to properly fund the U.S. Postal Service so that we can restore mail delivery, especially during a pandemic where so many people are basically stuck at home. And so they need the mail to function for all sorts of reasons, from getting prescriptions in the mail to getting bills and checks on a timely basis. And as we, I think, saw in a really horrifying way, being able to vote on time. I worry about the special elections that we're about to have, or not, there's not special runoff elections that we're about to have in Georgia, because voters there need the mail to be functional as well.
And one of your, and this will be my last question, I know you need to go, so I want to ask you about your specialty, which I think is fair to say that one of your specialties is money in politics. And so regarding those two runoff elections that are coming up in Georgia, where the eyes of the entire nation will be on those two races, potentially for control of the U.S. Senate, what can you say about how much money you expect in those races and how much money was spent already in the 2020 election cycle?
Yeah, so the 2020 election cycle so far is going to be the most expensive federal election that we've ever had. It looks like the total as of election day is going to be $14 billion. And the two Georgia elections for who is going to represent Georgia in the U.S. Senate are likely to gain enormous fundraising, enormous spending, and it's hard to predict in the abstract, but you know, I think those could easily be $100 million races each. So it'll boost some people always get rich off of these horrible ways that we fund our elections. And I think what I hope is that more of that money goes to actually engaging voters instead of spending all of that money purely on advertising to manipulate voters.
Well, Professor Chara Torres-Spellacy, I'd like to thank you so much for coming back on WMNF's Midpoint Monday.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a good one.
Thank you, you too. Professor Chara Torres-Spellacy is a professor of law at Stetson University College of Law, and you're listening to Midpoint Monday. What do you think? We have a few minutes left in the show, so here's the number to join the conversation, 813-239-9663. You can also email dj at wmnf.org, or you can text 813-433-0885. So Rob in Thanota-Sassa has been holding a long time. Thanks so much, Rob. What would you like to say?
Oh, hi, Sean. Great show. I wanted to say that, you know, I think the election of Joe Biden has a lot of repercussions outside of what's going to be the impact on our country. In a time when, you know, you have like an emerging superpower in China and a reemerging old nemesis in Russia, They have different, and you know, you also have Iran, which is a theocracy. You have authoritarian and dictatorship of the, you know, in China, the sort of the communist dictatorship there. And these are competing with our view of how to run a country. And the free world needs the example of the United States. You know, our institutions were tested. I had friends who were very worried about, and we've heard programs and speakers about this sort of, I don't know, authoritarianism light or fascism light that's represented by Trump and his more rabid followers. But I think it's very heartening and almost moving that the American people responded to that, and also that the institutions that we have held up under stress, you know, and they have held up. And I think that's a wonderful example to the world, and it reaffirms the idea that participatory democracy and the rule of law is the way to go, and that it's not weak and it's not chaotic and that it's not doomed in some way. So I think that's why you see, I think you sense, people sense a gigantic sigh of relief in many parts of the world over the fact that we've repudiated this movement towards sort of authoritarianist-esque populism.
All right, Rob, thank you so much. I'm going to move on. We have a lot of other people on the line, but thank you so much for calling in. We're going to go now to David in Tampa. Hi, David. What's on your mind?
Hi, Sean. Just real quick, I'd like to put some kudos out there to the United States Post Office. All those things that were supposed to come true, none of them came true. The ballots were delivered on time, et cetera, et cetera. So thanks to all the postal people that may be listening.
Yeah, the great workers of the USPS, despite all the hurdles put on top of them by the way, way, way upper management, they got it done, didn't they?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And for a postal service that's been reconfigured against a first-class mail, which for obvious reasons, they just did a fantastic job with first-class mail as far as ballots are concerned.
Did you mail in your ballot?
I did, sir.
All right. And were you able to check to see if your vote got counted?
I didn't really think to check because I have, again, a lot of faith in the post office. I've owned a business for over 40 years. Never had a piece of mail lost ever in 40 years.
All right, David, thanks so much. You bring up an excellent point. I appreciate you calling in.
Yeah, bye.
All right, bye-bye. Thank you. And you're listening to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. It's 12:53 in the afternoon. We are talking about the election. We're talking about the election results and what you think about it. I'm going to go to some more callers in just a minute. I have a whole bunch of emails I could read when I get a chance. I apologize. I haven't gotten to any very many recently. DeMarco writes in and says, left-wing violence is Nazi scapegoating, Republican gaslighting, and fascist projection. The only people convicted for organized effort fomenting violence around the BLM protest is the right-wing violent extremist group, the Proud Boys, whose goal is to start a race war. The group and other Trump supporters who shot 3 people and killed 2 who shot nonviolent BLM protesters with paintball guns were all incited by President Trump. So thank you for those thoughts, DeMarco. There was a man who was actually shot and killed by a police or a SWAT team or something who was going to be charged with violence, a left winger, presumably out in Oregon, I believe it was. But you're right, almost all the other deadly violence, especially, and a lot of the violence in, of all sorts locally. I mean, we've reported on so much violence here in the local area with protesters getting beaten up or protesters getting run over by, hit by cars, things like that. That's either been the police or it's been right-wing anti-protesters. I haven't heard of any violence by people who are supporting the BLM movement or supporting, I guess, liberal or progressive candidates. Correct me if I'm wrong. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Teresa in St. Petersburg. Welcome to the show, Teresa.
Hi. I think the most important thing that happened during this election is that we don't have to listen to Trump anymore and all of his tweets. My neighbor down the street.
Hang on, Teresa. You think that Donald Trump is going to give up his Twitter account?
No, he's not going to, but do we have to pay attention to them after January 20th? Do we need to pay any attention to them is what I'm saying. I'm not going to. He's going to be irrelevant to me. My neighbor had the best thing. He said, you know why they call him Sleepy Joe? And I said, why? He goes, because now that we'll all be able to get good night's sleep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, exactly. We won't be afraid to go to sleep at night, thinking that more is going to happen. And about the Senate, we still have those two in Georgia, possibly to flip it to the Democrats. If we can't, you know what I think would be the best case scenario is if we tie it up and force them to work together.
I'm at a disadvantage here. I forgot to pull up.
I think tying it up may just force them that we have to work together. Otherwise, I don't know how Joe's going to reunite this country. We are so divided. He can give it his best shot, but I don't have much faith in us being united.
So my recollection is that I think that if the Democrats win the two seats, that would be 50-50. I could be wrong. I don't have that page pulled up.
Will it? Oh, that could be good. See, that's what when we can't flip it, I'm thinking that would be the best case scenario, because then it will force them to work together. And even though the vice president will get to do the final tally, maybe that will make him work together. I think that's our only hope, because if the Senate and the House won't work together and unite and try to figure something out, I don't see the rest of us in this country. We're just going to stay divided until our government works together.
All right. Thank you for those thoughts, Teresa. I'm going to try to squeeze in a couple more, three or four more calls. Ruby in Tampa, you're on the line. Hi. Thanks so much for calling. Ruby, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. I'd just like to comment on what happened with the election. We have an electoral vote system. He won the electoral vote. It's for these right-wingers. That would be the end of it. I don't understand why they contest every single thing that Democrats do. We have a constitution. It's worked for 240-something years. And this is the only election that has been as contentious as it is. And I don't know how this country can be united with the Republican Party trying to continue to be so divisive.
All right. Thank you so much, Ruby. I'm going to move on, unless you have something else you'd like to add.
Nope. That's my comment.
All right. Thanks so much. I appreciate that. And Josh in Clearwater, what would you like to say?
Yes, basically I'm just commenting on the election results. I think once again what I saw was the nation's divided again, and we're going to stay divided because I don't see anyone tackling the root problems of how we got divided in the first place. I think middle-class families across our nation are struggling with all the costs of healthcare rising and payroll not going up, and I think the Democrats and Republicans are going to continue to point fingers at each other until maybe they all roll up their sleeves and realize that America's hurting, that our middle class is hurting bad. And that's what I saw in the election results, and that's why I comment.
All right. Thanks, Josh. I appreciate that. I think we might have time. Let's see if we can get Dory on the air. I'm gonna put Dory on the air right now. All right, you're on the air, Dory.
Hey, just a suggestion to get Congress to work together in the Senate. Let's start with health care. 2022 is just down the corner.
What about health care? Quickly, if you can, what would you like to see?
Well, I think back in 2018, I think people spoke and wanted health care. Joe Biden did run on it besides COVID. I think if you want to undeadlock the Senate, put health care on the table. 2022, Congress is going to matter. Make them show their cards.
Thanks so much, Dory. Appreciate that. Thanks so much for everyone for calling in and emailing and texting. That's all we have time for right now. But I want to thank Miss Julie, DT, and Robert Fitzpatrick for their help on the show. I'm Sean Canaan. Oh, I also want to thank my guest, Chara Torres-Pellacy, professor of law at Stetson University College of Law, for that interview. So tomorrow at noon, your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. I'd like you to stay tuned now for Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening to WMNF Tampa. NPR News is coming up in 15 seconds.